with tonight's thought. I am a phony. I am an insecure and unattractive person. That felt good to say. It felt good to type. Yeah, I found out today that this website still exists, something like 10 years later. It was invented as a novelty by the comedian John Oliver, who hosts that show, that weekly news show on HBO. And it's been a while since I've seen that bit that he did, but I think the general gist of it was that the world is becoming so toxic because we are now compelled to go on to all these social media platforms and just type in any whim, any passing thought that comes through our heads, right? Has to get out of us, and we have to satisfy like that primal tactile need for catharsis, right? Just getting something out of our heads and like through our fingers into the keyboards and just sending it out there. And he came up with this website where we could do that. And we don't have to, worry about the angry reprisals of like our family members who don't agree with us, or like the people that we went to high school with and haven't seen in 20 years. We can just get, write the most terrible things, our deepest, darkest secrets, and just confess them. The same way we can onto social media, but this time, like, there's nobody to hear it, nobody to see it, right? Like, yeah. So like my first crush was on a rainbow bright doll. And much later than it should have been, right? Yeah, so there it is. And it just kind of goes off into like a black circle surrounded by gas and stars and forming a spiral that goes into the singularity. And it's just, there's not a cloud to store it to or anything. I don't know. This website's very cheap. I think that's what they were going for. Yeah, so that doll was also my first kiss. And yeah, this like, it screams for you and all that. And yeah, it just has that, it satisfies everything, that visual, that texture, that tactile thing, that audio. It gives you sort of everything that you want when you type something in, and you don't have to like continuously check for updates to see if people agree with you or disagree with you. It's kind of a nice feeling screaming into the void. Yeah, like sometimes I cry during the act of thinking and just scream that into the void. There it goes, right then and there. Yeah, I can't believe this website's still up. It's kind of amazing, I think it's just like incredibly cheap for them to run or whatever. And but even so, just the fact that like it's got to cost something. I don't know. There's been a bunch of websites, social media sites that have I think do the same job that Scream Into the Void does just as nicely, putting stuff up there and trying to get people to follow it and comment on it and everything, but just to no avail, right? And I think the most notable of these recent social media platforms that does that, where you basically are just screaming into the void, saying these things with like nobody to really pay attention to you or hear you, is probably Substack, Thank you. right? Like I've been on Substack now for a couple of years, and not saying I've been terribly active on it, but there have been periods where I go on there and I do post like a lot of material, and it's really hard to get noticed on that platform. To be on Substack, the reason I moved to it in the first place was because it was a free place to host all my stuff. I no longer had to, you know, pay for a domain name and pay for web hosting through like Squarespace or anything else, and it was just a good place to host the podcast and host anything else I did. So I moved to Substack a couple of years ago, and I have been enjoying the platform for the most part, but the thing that I notice is that it's just difficult to for anybody to find you on there. You know, I don't know. I've been, one thing that they've been doing is, I think it's because Substack really has prided itself on being like the thinking man's social media, I suppose. Like, you know, there's a lot of writers on there, a lot of really big writers, right? Like Salman Rushdie was one of the early writers to adopt Substack. You know, this Booker Prize award winning author of the Satanic Verses, and just a writer's writer, just one of the greatest living novelists alive, I suppose. And yeah, he got on there and started writing blogs and short stories and things like that. And so it's sort of prestigious, Substack is. I mean, even having like the .substack.com name is kind of shows people that you sort of take writing seriously or whatever. And I think it's just a website that was created for people like me who are just tired of this idea of creating just quote unquote content, right? Just having things that they create just be sort of labeled these like commodities to be gobbled up and then forgotten just for you to create content the next day. So I really did like Substack, the fact that it was free and the fact that it just seemed to have a really good philosophy. But ever since then, they have been, in the past couple of years, I got into it, right, kind of when it was becoming big. Like people were starting to talk about it as just being the exciting new platform, you know, for people who want to post more serious content than just, you know, memes and just political news from like far right organizations or far left organizations that haven't been fact checked or anything like that. So, yeah, I got into the philosophy a little bit, but again, like, but over the years, like Substack is becoming increasingly more like all those social media platforms, in the fact that it is getting popular and is attracting more and more people who just want to come on here and like post memes and things like that. They added this notes feature a while back to where in addition to posting like blogs and podcasts and video and things like that, you could come on here and just post little short form, what they call is just short form writing, but it's really just a Facebook post. Okay. I don't know, Substack just has a very unique algorithm to where like you go on here and you can post a note, and even though you have people who follow you and have people who subscribe to you, it's almost impossible to get anybody to see your notes, right? And I haven't been posting notes consistently, but in the past couple of weeks I have been. And I've been going on to Substack generally in the mornings, like when I'm working or whatever. And I will I'll play something on Spotify and I'll post it on my notes. And I'll just say, like, this is what I'm listening to this morning. And I copy the album link from Spotify and I put it into the note. And what's really cool is it actually like embeds the playlist. So if people saw the note, they could play the music that I'm listening to. And those notes and just almost pretty much every note I've ever posted now. I don't know if I can find out exactly how many I posted, but it's probably around maybe 100 or so over like a 2-year period, I'd say. Yeah, probably 100 or so. But yeah, I've got 23 subscribers. So the idea is like people who subscribe to you and people who can, who follow you also, you know, right. Can they can see your notes, but I never, ever get any likes on them whatsoever. And I'm really like believing that nobody, the algorithm just for some reason is not promoting, what I'm saying or anything like that. And, I kind of like that actually, you know, I kind of like the fact that, it is this platform, unlike Facebook, because I'm very self-conscious about posting on things like Facebook and Instagram, because I have a lot of friends that I've curated on those platforms over the years. And I sort of just am, because of how many friendships I've sort of seen fractured, not my own, but like just other people's over the years, it does make me really self-conscious to post things on there, because I don't want to get into some kind of a comment war back and forth with them, right? And yeah, likewise, I also really don't like to post something because of the impulse that I have to constantly see if it's getting likes and if it's getting comments and things like that. Even though that's nice, it's just sort of like I've got better things to do with my time, right? So yeah, like the solution has been really good lately. I just kind of go on to my Substack and I post a note, and I satisfy that just instinct that I have, that like reptilian hindbrain impulse to just get something out of me. And there it is. It's in there. And it really just is like screaming into the void. And I kind of like that in a way. I mean, maybe someday I'll get enough subscribers who can actually, you know, who are actually on Substack every day, I believe, to like see me. But, you know, for now, it's like totally fine. I'm kind of happy with just where I am right now with Substack. But yeah, it made me think about this Scream Into the Void website, right? That is on here on the internet. And I believe it was, yeah, like about 10 years ago or so that he did that bit. And it just made me think about it today, that like this is essentially the same thing that Substack is, you know, except for theoretically people can see it, but I really don't think so. I don't think the algorithm is going to favor me over somebody like, you know, Salman Rushdie. I don't know. Right. Yeah. Oh man. So yeah, here I am. I'm back on the page. Let's do like one more, not on Substack, but let's scream into the void. Let's say like, I really worry that Donald Trump. No, I don't want to do that. I'm afraid to get political even on screamintothevoid.com, right? Yeah. And speaking, of course, of Screaming Into the Void, this is The Midnight Citizen Show. I am your host, Mike Booty. I've actually got a notification here on Substack. Oh, somebody liked my note. Oh my gosh, I'm so bad. I'm so glad somebody actually liked my note right as I was talking about nobody liking my notes. I think I just actually, yeah, this is a good segue, okay? Because I am going to talk about the fact that I did get my most liked. I did get like likes on a note. I've gotten hearts on a note before, you know, and actually comments too on some of them, but very, very rarely, very rarely. And I did an experiment the other day where I was actually seeing if I could get the Substack algorithm to recognize me, to actually promote something that I had to say. And yeah, so I went onto Reddit and people were talking about this. Of course, I'm not the only person talking about this, but, you know, everybody is wondering on Reddit, like, I've been on Substack for years. I can't get anybody to see my notes. Nobody's commenting. What am I doing wrong? Right. And of course, you got a bunch of like very smug writers on there, very sub, you know, smug, as they call themselves, Substackers. Right. And they're just like, just write good content. Okay. And they're like, but I do write good content. You know, their common retort is, I do write good content. I spend hours on my content, and I spend, you know, hours curating and cultivating my notes. And nobody ever notices them. And meanwhile, somebody who just writes, you know, this is my first Substack post, they get hundreds of likes and thousands of comments. And why is this? So I think like what happened is, and I went onto Substack and I just did this an experiment. This was last Sunday morning. And it's not that this wasn't true at all, because I had been reading Substack all morning. I was going around to the various newsletters of, you know, people I subscribe to and just reading some of the things they had to say, you know, who weren't behind a paywall. You know, that's the thing about Substack, is that it does very heavily encourage you to charge your followers and your subscribers for the things that you publish for them. And I've always been non-commercial. I'm not really interested in that at all. I'm just interested in the free hosting. But of course, Substack is a for-profit company. So the idea is that if they're going to make money by giving you free web hosting, then they're going to promote you for in turn promoting them, right? So yeah, knowing this and figuring this out, I went on and I just posted a note last Sunday morning, and I said just simply, you know, Substack's been a wonderful place this Sunday morning. I'm sorry that I'm a broke adjunct professor and can't pay any of you, but I will read anything you give me for free. Okay. So I posted that on Sunday, and yeah, here it is. It's Friday night, about 10 minutes after midnight. And over the course of the past week, since I posted that note, you know, I've got five hearts. And that's more than I've ever gotten, more likes, more hearts than I've ever gotten on any single Substack note that I've posted. So and I got a new free subscriber out of it also, so that's awesome. Cool. So what does that bring me up to now over there on Substack? Yeah, I'm at 23 subscribers. Okay. So I'm a long way from asking people to pay for what I do. Okay. Which is what Substack, you know, wants you to do. And I think it's honestly, you know, I'm just one of these people. I've been on here for 2 years now, publishing content, not consistently. Like, I come out and I do my podcast sort of in phases, almost like a series of a television show or something. And that was like a very British way that I just say that, like a season of a television show, right? You know, I come out and I do maybe like 6 or 7 podcasts in a row, and then I kind of drop off for a while, and then I pick up and do another series. And yeah, I think Substack's algorithm is just recognized by now that I'm not a reliable source of income. So I think I've like permanently damaged my reputation in their eyes or something. So they're just going to like keep me in the back, but in a way that's kind of good, right? You know, it is, it just goes back to that feeling of playing Little League and just thanking God so much that your coach, you know, puts you in a backup left field. You know, again, I think that's the feeling I get on Substack, right? I could just do anything on it. Nobody will notice. But it feels good to do it, so. Yeah, I have just been incredibly enjoying just the act of creating things lately, and just working on podcasts and also doing the vlogs that I'm also posting up on Substack, but also on YouTube. And not really, once they're out there, just not really promoting them that well. Like, I may do something, like throw something up there on Instagram, like the cover of my latest show. But I did a vlog last weekend, and I felt like it was really good. Like, if you haven't seen any of my vlogs, I think maybe go check them out if you want to. If you don't, I mean, that's okay. But, you know, just this idea of like producing video stuff and is something that I've always wanted to do to promote the show, and have indeed done from time to time. over the years, but just not consistently. And what's been happening lately with the vlogs is I've just been shooting them over the course of about a, you know, 1 to 3 day period, and then spending the weekends editing them, and just getting a lot of joy out of that. It just feels like I'm making a movie, right? Like every week, and editing it together, and creating narratives that go through the lifespan of the vlog. So it's not just like a day in the life. This is what I did, right? I'm really trying to think about it in terms of like the way a filmmaker thinks about a movie. I'm not trying to get too grandiose, but I am doing that. I'm actually trying to create something that is a little bit more than just like, you know, this is my dishwashing routine, right? So I'm doing that and like just getting so much joy out of that. And it's almost like just by the time I post it to Substack or I post it to YouTube, it's just out there and it feels like I don't care about it anymore after that. You know, I just got it out of me. It's almost like this, like, monastic kind of act, kind of practice, I suppose, right? Of just getting it out of me, right? And it's just been amazing these past few weeks as I've been, curbing like these things that I feel like I have to do every day in order to be at peace, and just curbing my cigar smoking and curbing my alcohol consumption. And don't get me wrong, I still do those things, but like it's fun to just come in and not do them as much and actually concentrate that energy on, you know, like, just creating these vlogs and podcasts. I've gotten like a lot of joy out of it over the past couple of weeks, right? And also just as a way to, I mean, you know, like, let's face it, it's just a way to, like, frankly, the world has been, there's been a lot to talk about in the world, but there's also a lot that you want to avoid about the world. So it's good to just have that frustration and that irritation, right? It's just these, people who don't really seem to care about any of us, telling us what to do and running the world and basically handling our entire livelihoods and dangling them above us, right? And it's been a good way to kind of escape all of that, I suppose. Yeah, it's just, it's tough days, right, to just not get on there and not scream into the void, but actually scream into just like a very crowded theater. Just share your opinions and your frustrations with everybody else about what's going on. But it's still just, I don't want to do that. I don't feel like it. I don't know. I guess I can do it a little bit on this show because, again, this is all part of the monastic experience. It is very often like screaming into a void and just getting in here and just, knowing that most people are not going to, I mean, this is like, you know, recording an audio tape and putting it in a bottle and throwing it out of the ocean. Maybe somebody will pick up on it all someday, you know, I don't know, but you know, but yeah, it's just tough to, not get on, I don't know, social media platforms and vent about the awful state of the world on the very thing, the very device, the very platform that, I very well believe put us in this situation, right? Yeah. Just like over the past, 20 years now, like an entire generation and some years of, human existence, we've just, had this way of like just any passing thought that comes through our minds. Like, we don't need to keep it. We don't need to hold it in. We don't need to shape those opinions and cultivate them and maybe turn them into something like really constructive, some kind of art or whatever. We just, you know, type it into, a box and hit enter and send it out there and just wait for people to respond with vitriol. Right. And yeah, it has become just like just this very like toxic way of, you know, communicating. And in a way, I don't know. I mean, I know it's like there are a lot of theories, right, to try and understand how we got here, but I do think that one universal theory that I feel like most people can probably agree with is the fact that it does have something to do with the fact that we now call it content instead of art. I think that's one of the reasons why, right? And yeah, I was sitting on the porch the other night with my friend Dave, and it was like a stormy night. We were really trying to talk and figure out why we both don't like the word content that much. Like, why do we have to, you know, call them content creators? Why do we, it's like we were already calling them creators. Why do we have to, you know, qualify it with the word content? And it is this word that has just been conjured up out of thin air by these tech giants, by the tech industrial complex, to sort of describe us as the people who work for them and make money for them. And, you know, we're in the past, what would happen is like, if you created something, you were just a creator, you were an artist or whatever. But now, you know, you make a vlog or you make a blog or whatever, you're a content creator, you're an influencer. So you're literally, you know, churning out products, and you're telling people about them, or you're telling people what to buy and things like that. And it's become this way of just turning all art, which used to coexist with commerce, into just something that just is commerce, right? And I think that is why we are in this, you know, current state of affairs right now, because we do have, you know, this president who functions on like an influencer logic, right? It's like this idea that in the first, you know, 3 weeks of his presidency, every day is like signing onto YouTube to see if your favorite influencer has given you new content, has uploaded something new. It's just, that's what it is. And the polls are seeming to rate him higher and higher and higher, even though, you know, that some of the people who are being polled, who are still standing behind him, even though some of them have got to be federal employees who, you know, some of the 77,000 or 220,000 probationary, you know, federal employees who were fired today, some of them have got to be the ones who responded to this poll. Do you believe that the president is doing a good job? Right. So I don't know what the polls are going to say now, but they seem to be like raking higher and higher, like all week long. Every time he, you know, opens his mouth and gets in front of a television camera and signs an executive order, doing an increasingly crazier thing, right? Like, you know, having, I don't know, like, you know, invade, like taking over the Gaza Strip and establishing a homeland for U.S. tourism there and things like that. You know, it's like, that's, people love it, you know, because he's a content president. He's an influencer president. Every time he creates new content, you know, it's just there because, like, we've been bred. We want that kind of stuff. Right. So I don't know. I think that's my theory. You can agree with it or not. I think that's what's going on. I didn't say any of the things half as articulately as I planned to before I started the show. But, you know, if you're still listening, thanks for staying with me. This is the Midnight Citizen Show. See, I'm tired of, I never ever throw those ideas out there, but it's one of these things lately where I don't know what else I can talk about. And, you know, am in the process, quite likely, of not having a job in the fall, because I do work for a public university that's run by the University of Alabama system. And they did just, you know, lose like a ton of research funding. Again, in the name of efficiency, right? Because, yeah, to people like Elon Musk, being efficient means just firing everybody and taking away money from people who are trying to cure cancer. And and these things have a way of trickling down at universities, right? Like the university loses a lot of money in research, and it trickles down to the schools, and usually the adjuncts like me are the first to go. And so the reason that people like me exist is so that the, you know, associate professors and the professors and all the tenured professors, right, they don't have to teach English composition to freshmen, right? So I rely on that kind of resistance. I need that, right? So, like, I will say this about Donald Trump. Like, I have never really felt affected by anything that a president has done, like, this strongly. You know, I haven't. It's really, you know, I got to hand it to him, you know, like, good job. Thanks. And, I saw this headline in The Atlantic this week, and I never can read The Atlantic because there's a paywall to everything, but they let you read, like, at least the headlines in the first paragraph. And the headline was talking about, like, it took Hitler 33 days to use the Constitution to dismantle the Constitution. Right? So, yeah, the clear indication, the clear parallel was that they were comparing Hitler to Trump, which is always something that people on social media platforms, right, have been doing for years, of course. But, you know, they don't have standards and practices. They don't have gatekeepers. They can say whatever they want, but this is The Atlantic. You know, one of the snootiest, snottiest rags run by, you know, fair-minded liberals. I'll definitely say that, you know, like far left. Some of them people who get a lot of pleasure in, you know, bringing down Republicans like Donald Trump, but never always being a little bit at least mindful of the rhetoric. And so, yeah, now they're, you know, comparing Donald Trump to Hitler, and which I did expect was going to happen in the press eventually. Like, eventually there were going to be headlines in the New York Times, you know, like comparing Donald Trump's actions with some of the things that Hitler started out doing. I just didn't think it was going to take like this short of amount of time. I thought it was going to be at least like after the first 100 days when we were going to start seeing those headlines, when Trump was going to get start getting compared to Hitler. Right. I didn't even think it was going to be before like William Henry Harrison Day, right? Which is, you know, 33 days. Is that right? Like the shortest serving president, because he stood outside on Inauguration Day without a coat and he got a cold and then he died. Right. That's always a milestone for any president. Can you make it longer than Harrison? And he hasn't yet. It hasn't been 33 days yet. I think we have another 2 weeks before that happens. But yeah, like even before he reaches the, you know, Harrison Day, he's getting compared, in The Atlantic to Adolf Hitler. Right. And again, I don't think this rhetoric is far off. I still wouldn't break out the Hitler analogy just yet, but I will say with him talking about like opening up Guantanamo and sending, you know, immigrants there, you know, doing things like just, it's like, it is an ethnic cleanse, and it does go beyond that. And it does seem like what he's trying to do is make this country really difficult for anybody who doesn't, or for anybody who relies on the government, and for anybody who, doesn't have under $1 million of net worth. And, you know, anybody who is interested in going into like the arts or basically anything that's not business, you know, because science also, that's kind of screwed. And he and, you know, his second in command, who is supposed to be J.D. Vance, but I mean, I don't know what he's doing. What has that guy been doing the past 3 weeks? All we hear about is Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk, right? prancing around the stage with his security detail on his shoulders, you know. And they really do seem to just be hell-bent on just dismantling the lives of millions of Americans in the name of efficiency. And it is very concerning. It's something that is just, especially me, is like, I just, you know, saw today that, right, like 77,000 federal employees did take the payout. So they left their jobs with the promise that they're going to get paid money, right, by, you know, through September. Even though Congress has like explicitly stated, like, we did not budget for this. How are we going to pay for this? Right. So, yeah, like Trump, I believe, gave them until February 13th to take the payout. And after that, he said, I can't ensure that you're going to have a job. OK. And so the people who stayed as federal employees and did not take the payout got fired today. Not all of them, of course, not the whole federal government. It's not there yet. That'll probably happen sometime next week. But they said like up to 220,000 federal employees could lose their jobs over the course of the next week. These are all probationary employees, these people who have been working for the government for less than 2 years, just lost their jobs. These are people who work in the, of course, the Department of Education, which is about to go completely. People in the Bureau of Consumer Protection. Am I saying that right? These are the people who got us seatbelts and the people who protected little girls' hair from being eaten by Cabbage Patch dolls. These people are gone now. And it's definitely efficient, I guess. I mean, we're going to be saving a lot of money by not paying those people right now. But where are those people supposed to work? What is the plan for this? You know, and I just think like that's all I want to know is that, OK, if you're doing this and you have an end game, then that's fine. Tell us. But what just I mean, why? What stands to be benefited from dismantling the Federal Board of Education, which is a very bloated government organization, yes, but they also are in charge of making sure that poor kids go to school. Like this whole Republican ideology that the, you know, party is built on, this ragged dick Horatio Alger story of being poor and, you know, growing up and like pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. And like, how can you do that if you're like literally just taking away their boots? I don't get it at all. You know, I'm confused. But it does concern me that, yeah, like, I mean, come fall, I may very well not have a job. I just don't know that anywhere in education is safe at all. So I don't know. But, yeah, it's just the going to school as like a teacher every day is just strange because in the past, going to school and, you know, working with kids and you look at them and they just don't seem to have much curiosity in anything, much interest in anything, and just being the way that kids are. But I think these days it's sort of framed in a completely different way. Like, how do they maintain any hope that this world is normal, that this world that they're going into is normal? Like, why would they want to grow up and be a part of that? Of this world, I don't know. I think it's like a different way of, like, I was really thinking about the idea that the students that I teach are 19, 20 years old. And so they have not had a really true idea of what politics as usual looks like since they were 8 or 9 years old and not even paying attention to anything. And they probably pay attention less now than they do ever because, like, they just, this is what they grew up with. It's like completely different from the way that I grew up watching politics, which was like, you still got like a really good idea from watching the politicians of who stood for what. And, you know, like just looking at like somebody like Bob Dole and just being like all old and stiff. And you got an idea of what the Republicans were. Right. And just like looking at George W. Bush, like just the stiff guy standing up there and barely able to get like a sentence out. And just being like endlessly mocked and caricatured. And then you see like Bill Clinton, and he's like all loose, and he's, you know, sleeping with women, and he's like playing the saxophone. He's got his shades on and everything. And you're sort of like, oh, the Democrats are like, you know, the party of the young and the party of the hip. And so you totally understood. I think even when I was like a little kid, I was like 11 or 12 years old, I still understood the divide between the Republicans and the Democrats. Right. And yeah, I just think I grew up with like this idea that like politics was a difficult, serious business, and it had to be filtered down and modified and reformed and fed to younger people to get them to understand what it was all about. But you don't have to do any of that anymore. Like when I was growing up, it was all the New York Times, and now it's more like, it's just all, it's X and it's Facebook, and it's like just easy, digestible forms of content that are just fed to us in ways that just like we don't have to have any of those filters anymore. We just we see like exactly what it is, and it's just like ugly and it's angry, and it just really just a sad state of affairs, you know. And yeah, like, I mean, a while back, like I was teaching a class at the community college, and I looked behind the podium, and there was a VCR there. And I asked my students, have any of you ever seen a VCR? And like, just none of them had. None of them knew what in the world I was talking about. Right. And so, yeah, they had no interest in it at all. It was something that they didn't know about. They were not curious about it. They had no interest in seeing, you know, how we watched things before streaming and before our phones. And I just was kind of thinking that, you know, like that's sort of like in a way politics, and that's sort of in a way government and democracy, right, is they've grown up so long without really seeing how it truly functions, how it's supposed to work, that they don't like when we come out of this, right, in 4 years, I don't really know that they're going to have an interest in it. They're going to have a curiosity for how it's all supposed to work. They're just going to see how it's been working, right, and they're just going to move forward from there and, you know, not go back. So I think. Anyway, is this making sense? I don't know. Yeah, on a lighter note, last week I made a couple of mistakes I want to correct. Number one, I was calling that new agency, I don't know, that quasi-government agency is how they're identifying it, run by Elon Musk as the Office of Government Efficiency, I believe. I wasn't calling it by its real name, which was the Department of Government Efficiency. Yeah. The acronym is DOGE. I think like subconsciously I was like, he wouldn't really call it DOGE. Like, isn't that cryptocurrency that crashed or whatever? Like, why would he want to try and summon up that image in people's mind of like this Office of Government Efficiency that has the same acronym as just this failed cryptocurrency. But I don't know. Then I realized that everything Elon Musk does is self-promotion and self-preservation. And he has a lot of stake in Dogecoin. So I think he did that like just the same way he named Twitter X, is just so he can keep the branding consistent. I think that's what it probably was about. So yeah, there's the Department of Government Efficiency that goes about making things efficient, the way that I clean up my hard drive by just, you know, purging everything and worrying about it later. I suppose that's what he's going to do. Yeah. And the other thing I also made a mistake on is I made a mistake calling. I was talking last week about the tech industrial complex and this disruptor, you know, lie that we were all fed and that we went along with, you know, these people who are disruptors. And I guess it wasn't a lie. They did disrupt things. I mean, they're disrupting, you know, it led to disrupting a lot of things. Right. Not for the good things, disrupting things in like ways that benefited them. And yeah, but I was sort of talking about how this whole narrative, I think it goes back a long way, but I really think it went mainstream when Apple came out with this campaign in like the 90s. And I misidentified it. I called it Crash Different. The name of the actual campaign was Think Different. Think Different. And let me see if I can find the video for it here. It's, you know, this thing like comparing what Apple does with like Gandhi. And I think Martin Luther King Jr.'s in there. Yeah, he's actually the face of the YouTube thumbnail. But yeah, Steve Jobs narrated it. And yeah, this is Think Different.
Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels.
Bob Dylan.
The troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them, because they change things. They push the human race forward. While some may see them as the crazy ones,
Alfred Hitchcock,
we see genius.
Jim Henson.
Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Oh, somebody put like, oh, this is like a something that was made. Yeah, there's the Think Different logo, right, with Apple on it. Somebody yeah, remade this video, remixed it to put Steve Jobs' face at the end. And yeah, Steve Jobs, 1955 to 2011. So, you know, yeah, like I just watched that commercial and I'm like, that what balls like Apple had comparing what they did, like using Gandhi to sell their products, using Martin Luther King Jr. Like, would we have allowed that today? I don't know. We always talk about that. Did this age well? All right. I don't think it did. Yeah, you don't want to sell like, you know, Gandhi, especially like a product named Apple. Like when Gandhi looks at the camera and he's sort of smiling and, you know, you just think about the fact that this is a guy who can't even eat. You have a company that you're naming after a fruit that he would so gladly take from you if he had just like an ounce of I don't know. What am I trying to say? So yeah, like there were all these commercials that you know, like Apple put out that was like Think Different, and just again, like just this disruptor myth that these are the people who don't settle for the status quo and all that. And, you know, that's now, you know, what it was like, this was, you know, in the late 90s. So 25, 26, 27 years later, we have this philosophy, and it's sort of gotten people fired from their jobs and really uncomfortable to live in this country. And, you know, just, I don't know, some things I think just like the status quo kind of works fine. You know, again, even if you're going in and you're shaking up the status quo, maybe understand what your end game is a little bit, I think. I don't know. And yeah, like Apple had to go through like a lot of different products, a lot of different prototypes to get to the iPhone that still doesn't really work all that well. That's one thing for a company. I don't really want that to be something that, you know, for America, I don't want to have to go through a lot of different, prototypes, of firing people and getting rid of government departments before we finally find out which are the ones that we need. But yeah, like, the reason I called it Crash Different, was because my friend Hunter, made this video years ago that, pre-YouTube, that actually ended up going viral. So I'm like looking it up right now and like, yeah, this was posted by my friend Hunter 17 years ago and, on YouTube, and it has now 64,000 views, which isn't a whole lot in the grand scheme of YouTube, but, yeah, like before YouTube, we put it out there. Like Hunter was a member of my sketch comedy group, Happy Nowhere, that I was in like in 2002 to 2004, before it disbanded and, you know, the, founders moved out to Los Angeles where they still live to this day. I still keep in touch with them. But yeah, they were down the street one night at, Leo Ticelli Productions editing some video, and like Hunter was there, he was an editor, and his Mac kept crashing on him. So they went into the soundstage and they filmed this video here, and it's just called Crash Different. And I'll post a link in the show notes. So yeah, let me pull this up. Hunter's got a very specific, very manic way of speaking. And, something that I became quite a very good imitator of in the 3 years that I lived with him, and a few other guys. So
is all Mac-based now. I mean, you know, there are programs out there on the PC, but whether you're using Avid or using Final Cut Pro, you're working on a Macintosh. Using a Mac is a little different than using a PC. It's not so much operating a computer as it is sort of tricking it, fooling it into doing what it is you really want it to do. You kind of have to sneak up on a Mac. I don't feel like I'm operating the Mac so much as I'm just there sharing the Mac experience. And if I can do something useful while the Mac is willing, so much the better. One of the coolest features of the Macintosh is it's really easy to shut down. All you have to do is be using a piece of software and then poof, it goes away. It's gone. It's shut down. You didn't push any buttons. You didn't close. You didn't even save. It's just gone. Unless you want to shut down a Mac. Oh, that's a whole nother story. I mean, you try to close a program and it locks up, and then you do that funny, what is it, the cloverleaf period thing? These unnatural and ultimately useless interrupt keys. Then nothing moves. Then you push the power button and it won't turn off. You go around and unplug it, and you better hope you're not on a laptop, because then you got to find the damn battery and try to pull that out, or the thing will never shut down. So I put my CD in the CD-ROM tray, and I'm copying media off that CD, dragging it onto my desktop, dragging it onto my desktop, dragging it onto my desktop. I eject it, and where did my files go? It's the only operating system I know of where click and drag does not mean you actually copy or move anything. No, you're just making shortcuts on your desktop. So I've got my next CD, and I slam it into the CD-ROM tray, and lo and behold, it starts playing all by itself. I'm looking for a way to turn it off. Finally, out of desperation, I click and drag the CD into the garbage can. The system locks up. So I go to the cloverleaf period spacebar thing, hoping I can stop the program, and I get a little caution window saying, careful, interrupting this program may lock up the system. I try to click OK, but the system's already locked up!
I like the handle here. That's so you can attach a chain and use it as a boat anchor!
Oh, those are those old iMacs that had like the little handle behind them.
On me, because I'm working late at night, at the corner of my eye, I keep seeing this thing jumping up and down. The update manager is bouncing at the bottom of the screen like a Jack Russell fucking terrier. So I'm looking around in the list of the files, trying to find the executable it wants me to update. And if I click on any one of them by accident, I rename it. Oh no, it's been renamed nothing. It was some kind of important system file, and the computer crashes. On a PC, no data is really lost. I mean, there's a way to undelete a file. If you know what you're doing in DOS, you can go in and recover anything that's been corrupted. On a Mac, if you lose a file, you run to the store to get a copy of the Mac version of Norton Utilities. You run back only to have Norton go, "You idiot! You own a Macintosh! The file is fucking gone! It's just gone!" Don't have any tools or any kind of buttons or whatever dials or switches in the bottom of the screen, because if you reach for them, the dock menu comes up. got to like angle around
just
and
destroy the computer
to get to the control. It's kind of like boxing with your computer. I can put it on the bottom, I can put it on the left, I can put it on the right. No, I can't put it on the top. That's reserved for the mighty Blue Apple. My name is Hunter Kressel. I'm an editor, and I cut together everything you saw tonight on a Macintosh.
Hunter still looks like that. You know, like 22 years later, he still looks like that. He's like just perpetually ageless. It's crazy. So yeah. Yeah. Written by Chris Nuccio and Hunter Kressel. Yeah. Chris Nuccio. Yeah. Rest in peace. He passed away. But yeah, this was so crazy because just like in my mind last week on my show, I just was associating, you know, Apple products and Mac with crashing all the time. And I to the point where I actually just like associated their iconic campaign that brought them so much fame in the 90s when Steve Jobs came back to the company with just crash different. Right? So I think, yeah, that was why I was doing it. I called it crash different like four or five different times last week on last week's show. When I meant to say think different, but I don't care. Because you probably didn't notice because you're here in the void with me. So, you know, I don't know. We'll get through it. We'll get through another week, you know, here in the world. Whatever the hell. Thanks for joining me here this week on the Midnight Citizen Show. You can catch me over at mikesbonfire.substack.com and maybe like one of the notes that I post over there. I don't care. I sort of like it if you don't sometimes, because it just allows me to say whatever I want to without being noticed. I don't know. It's really a great digital manifestation of being a human, I suppose, on this earth, especially in these days where it just feels like everything you do is kind of trivial. even though it's not, we're not. Oh my gosh, it's just late, you know. I went to go see, this was Valentine's Day, right? And I know I'm here in the office late on Valentine's Day night talking to you instead of being in there with my wife. But she said, yeah, go do it. It's fine. It's cool. It'll be a gift, right? to give you a little bit of time in there to do a show. And so, yeah, we went today to the movies to see Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It was playing there at the Sidewalk Twin Theater. And it's a pretty big house. Like, a lot of people were in there to go see this movie that I haven't seen in most likely, I think, like 15 years is the last time I saw it. I think Jessica and I watched it when we were first dating. But, yeah, it's one of these movies that just has as its, like, central argument that memories are probably the most important commodity that we have as human beings. And again, not to bring up, right, like Holocaust analogies or whatever, even though we may be in a time of like a cold Holocaust where, as I said, like, you know, our leaders really do seem to be getting off on weeding out all of the excess baggage. You know, the people who don't bring anything to the economy, you know, like the artists and the dreamers and the people, all those people basically in the Think Different ad would not be getting government assistance from Donald Trump. Right. Not to bring this up, but yeah, it's one of those reasons why some of the most precious things that were recovered from concentration camps were things like violins and things like, you know, basses, you know, those upright cellos that were, you know, played by Jews that in the concentration camps that the guards had appropriated to play the music while people walked off to the gas chambers. And, you know, there was this sense of like, just keep these people calm, right? Like music will evoke their memories and make them hopefully channel those emotions into just being calm as they go into certain death, right? And yeah, like, I mean, I don't know why I'm connecting these two things right now, but it is one of those things where the only true things that we have to sustain us in this world are the memories that we have of like better times, of things, of ideas that it can get better, and the ideas of like what true boring, you know, federal government business looks like, right? So I think as long as we have that, and as long as we keep talking about that, instead of just placing all of our focus on what this guy is doing and all these hypotheticals of what he's going to do tomorrow, we just have to, I think, just keep the memory of like how boring it used to be before these disruptors came to Washington and started messing with everything. And I think that really is like the only thing that's going to get us out of this. That's my opinion. But yeah, if you want to hear more of them, you know, again, a new vlog is up on Monday over at the mikesbonfire.substack.com, as well as YouTube at the _ Midnight Citizen Podcast. I'm also over at the Overnightscape Underground at onsug, onsug.com. And I will see you next time. Keep your eyes open. We'll be right back.